everybody. Welcome to episode 37 of Elo Punters. My name is Anurag Das, and I'm here with Daniel Goshal, and I'm here with Bob Wong, and we have our emergency episode update before Eternal Weekend. All right, if you guys are going to Eternal Weekend in Philly, not this weekend, but like next weekend, or if you're playing online, because, you know, Europe doesn't get an Eternal Weekend. I think it's kind of rude to say that out loud, actually. I take it back. Okay, actually, you know what? It is what it is. It's not on me. This is the episode where we talk about how to prepare, not really prepare for that, but like from a meta-wise, like what's shifted, what we should expect, that sort of stuff. So before we get into all of that, Bob, Daniel, how are you two doing?
I'm doing all right. So are you going to the one in Philly?
I am.
And are you playing or commentating?
No, God, no. I don't play Magic anymore. What?
Yeah, I told our friend Brandon that your paper retired. You just commentate in paper now, but you play online.
Yeah, I commentate in paper and then I make shows and that's about it. Daniel, say hello. Perfect. Okay.
Daniel, are you going to Eternal Weekend or just online?
You get the promo for top 8ing the online one as well, yeah. The pressure is on. Dude, do you want to know how much the ones from Japan sold for? It was like 800,000 yen or something was the asking price or something like that, which is insane. Between the Ponders, the Gush, and then the Brainstorm that's coming out next week in Philly for the Pro Tour thing, there's going to be some very rare, very expensive Eternal cards just like floating out and about. And I know I'm never going to be able to get them, but to whoever assembles the playset of those cards first, if you send a screenshot of the playset of them on a green screen, I will definitely Photoshop myself. It's like, you know how like teenagers will like walk up to like really cool cars and then they just like lean on the car and pretend to take a picture like the car is there? I do the exact same thing, but I'm thinking I just do it with Magic cards instead, right? Just like a really sweet foil set of like Ponders that are promoed out and extremely rare to get and worth like an entire car. So I don't think they're going to give like Ponders out every year.
Yeah, but this is the first promo, so.
Okay, cool. So I want to say thank you to our new patrons, Luis, Connor, Jay, Pascal, Balthazar. What is up? Thank you so much, everyone, for supporting the podcast. And you may be wondering, well, what does my support get us? Well, Force of Phil, at Force of Phil, a.k.a. Phil Blackman, a.k.a. The Triumph of St. Catherine, a.k.a. the coolest Magic rapper you ever met. Sorry, Remy. Our editor, he's great. He makes us sound great because he knows what great sounds like because he sounds great. And that's where it goes. So I appreciate that a lot. Thank you so much, Phil. Any updates, friends, on your personal lives? Because I'm thinking I do have a big update, but.
Go for it.
You're going to Worlds now?
Shame. Just kidding. Qualifying's pretty cool. What did you think about the, I don't know if you saw the drama with Karate Dom and like the Miss Triggers Phoenix versus Shieldred?
Wait, drama? Soup? Tea? No. He used the D word, Bob. What happened?
All right. So basically what happened was Phoenix players playing against Red Black and they had Shieldred out. Over the course of the game, the Shieldred player kept announcing the triggers whenever the Phoenix player drew. But then this time around, the Phoenix player didn't announce the triggers. And then the Phoenix player just started casting a bunch of draw spells. And then after that, Phoenix player is like, okay, you lose all this life. Or rather, the Shieldred player said that. And then the Phoenix player is like, no, you missed your triggers. And then there was a whole judge call, and it turns out that he did not miss his triggers, and the Phoenix player lost a bunch of life. And I guess the ruling is this way because anything that doesn't like have an impact on the board, you're not really considered to have missed your trigger unless something shows that you've missed your trigger. Even though he was, you know, announcing his trigger before, just because he didn't announce it doesn't mean he didn't miss it.
What? That is, I feel like the Phoenix player like made a bunch of those like card draw decisions because they thought that their opponent missed the trigger and then they wouldn't get in trouble for it. And then right. They got in trouble for it.
Well, that's the point. Like they thought that they were missing triggers and that's why they played it that way. And they didn't realize that's not how the rule works. So they thought it was a bad rule.
Well, this is just one person is wrong and the other person is right. Man, I thought this was actually drama, Bob. What the heck? This is whatever.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, here's the question. Do you guys think that rule is bad?
I like that it is a cleaner game of Magic, but I do not like that you have to... It's like one of those complexity things where like games are getting simpler over time, because rather than leave the complexity caked into the game, people are just like, you know what, let's just remind everybody or that they don't have to worry about their triggers anymore. Like, you know, that kind of thing. I feel like in the heat of the situation, it's like important to be able to like still remember everything that's going on the board. And all right, click this button so it goes on the trigger first, and then this trigger, stacking your triggers, doing all that sort of stuff. I don't know. I mean, like, at the end of the day, like, the rules are the way they are, and that's fine. And so right now, that's why I say it just sounds like someone is right and someone is wrong. But I do think that removing the option for error is a sort of simplification of the game that is not necessarily in the game's best interest. I don't know if it is or isn't. My gut reaction is that I would prefer to have a more complicated game, but I'm also not trying to recreate like Artifact. Like, I don't want to play that game. You know what I mean? So. I agree with Matsu in the chat, who's saying like, if the rule is bad, but it exists, you still play by the rules, right? It does, like, and that's why I'm saying in this situation, like, somebody is right, somebody is wrong. The person who is playing with Shieldred is in the right in this situation. Do I like the rule? No. I think it's kind of weird. I think it's like you're mentioning, Daniel, like Paper Magic, part of Paper Magic to me, maybe because it's just how I've grown up with Magic, is that you are responsible for your triggers. That's just like how it is. I get that they are trying to create a game that is simpler for people that are new to the game and coming to the game and being like, well, that's dumb. I missed my trigger because what, I didn't say it out loud? Like, I shouldn't have to do that. Especially at the RC level, we're not really catering to that kind of audience anyways. Like, that's where I think the rule should be like, gotta say the shit, you know what I mean? The way the game plays out too is just like, it goes both ways, right? Because the Phoenix player probably thought like, okay, they're missing their triggers, so this is where I'm going to continue to just, you know, keep drawing a couple cards. And then they made that decision actively because they thought that their opponent had missed their triggers or whatever it might be, right? And actually, you know, now that I think about this, it's the Phoenix player's fault for not knowing the rules at this point. But still, just like, you're right, Daniel, it's just like super messy. It's just like super messy and very confusing.
Is it on them for not knowing the rule? Because I feel like this is slightly different from all the other like trigger rules. Like, you just assume that like they have to announce it if it's their trigger.
So then what was the judge's explanation for why that wasn't the case? That doesn't make any sense at all. If you don't know the rules of the game, and then you do something that is against the rules of the game, you are 100% liable for not playing by the rules of the game or knowing about the rules of the game.
Yeah, let me clarify. So the judge actually was saying that he could have cast the opt in response to the Shielded trigger, and then that's why the person hadn't missed their chance for a trigger already. If he played let's say he played a land and then played the opt, then he would have missed the trigger. Actually, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if that would have made a difference.
Okay, like, that sounds even like more along the line of like, were just like saying shit randomly because what? This is why I really appreciate when like Jarvis plays Magic, because he's so clear every time he talks about every like single action. I think there were other players too, like Connor Mullally is another person who just like is like super crystal clear about like communications during games. This seems just like a product of like for Daniel, like just my opinion is like if the rules change somewhere in the back end, you're responsible for knowing what the rules are. It just is what it is. Even if it is done in the dead of the night, it is still your responsibility to like just be on top of the rules. Like as a player, I think that's just like what you are responsible for. And then also regarding this thing, it just seems like that sentence that you said, Bob, just really strikes me as weird. That just sounds like the judge is pulling something straight out of their ass, like for that one. I don't know. The way that now it's being phrased is a little bit different than from what I was originally thinking about, but like...
But then on the other hand, like there's also a timing issue. Like what if you draw your card and then immediately play opt and your opponent didn't have a chance to say trigger or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, then you say that it was like too fast. Like, man, wow.
Yeah, but then your opponent is already doing something, so then you need to be like, oh yeah, your opt resolves, but also there's a shielded trigger, so you want to make clear like if the trigger's on the stack or not. I don't know, I guess. Yeah, I agree with you there. Like, how am I supposed to know that certain trigger rules work certain ways? I think the only way you know is by going to tournaments and hearing stories like this or experiencing them yourself and then learning from that. There's no other way to, like, realistically do it. Nobody's going through and reading the comprehensive rules every time there's an update.
I know it sounds dumb, but, like if you find yourself at the end of a barrel and, like, a rule was changed and you didn't know about it, you cannot be like, oh, it's the rule's fault for changing. You know what I mean? Like,
so I think in that situation, I would be like, if I think it's a bad rule, I would blame the rule. I would just be like, yeah, I'm not mad at the judges. That's what he said. He's not mad at the judges because he thinks the judge made the correct ruling. But he thinks the ruling is bad, and that's why he's complaining about it on Twitter. So I don't see anything wrong with that. Like, if you think the ruling is bad, you think the ruling's bad.
Well, no, that's different. That's a different topic entirely. I'm saying, like, what I'm saying is, like, if you did not know the rule changed, you are liable for that. Now, it may have changed to something bad, and you may make an argument that is a bad rule, but that's different from, like, the fact that the rule changed and you were unaware of the rule change.
Yeah, I mean, if I were the Phoenix player, I wouldn't blame my opponent or the judge. I would blame the rule, more or less. I would just be like, well, that happened. I'm fine that I lost or whatever, but...
In this situation, you can only really blame yourself that you were not aware that the rule changed.
Yeah, but that's stupid, though. Yeah, because you can't be aware, first of all. What if they, like, made this, like, total, like, batshit rule that, like, if you, like, pick your nose, you lose the game, like, and you didn't know that rule was changed, like... Is that reasonable for you to know? Like, you can definitely blame the rule if it's a bad rule.
No, I would blame the process for, like, how rules change with zero transparency. Like, that would be something pretty bad, which maybe is what Dom or whoever is getting upset about. But, like, yes, you don't read, like, the rule changes in, like, the, what is it called? The MTR? Is that what it is? Or something like that?
Well, there's two things. There's the comprehensive rules, and then there's the MTR, which is, like, tournament rules.
Nobody practically reads those things, and that is a problem in and of itself. You not reading the rules and checking when they get updated does not exonerate you of the fact that, like, something could change in the future and then, like, oh, I've never done it before, therefore I don't have to do it again in the future. Like, that's not how that works, right? Like, you're just getting lucky that you already know all the rules and nothing is changing in a remarkable fashion.
I think there used to actually be, like, a pretty good judge blog, and I forget who it was, but basically every time there was, like, a big update to the MTR relating to triggers, like, they would have an article and explain how it changed. And yeah, those were useful articles to read because they gave examples and were easier to digest than something that's like the MTR, which is, like, you know, probably super dry. I don't know. So I think you're right. Like, you should probably, you know, try to read something. I just don't know if that thing still exists where they're, like, making updates to the MTR and having a blog explaining it. Maybe it still exists. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I do agree, though, that, like, the process in and of itself for these sort of updates, like, or like if something changes in the back end and everybody is not aware of it, because I had no idea it happened either, and I'm equally as guilty, but I would also say that if I was in that situation and I learned about it on the spot, I would say that's on me kind of deal. I do think that like lack of transparency is kind of a problem. So I would say that if this rule was recently changed and the fact that nobody knows about it or very few people know about it, I would, as a judge, probably look towards that and figure out how to increase the awareness, because...
I don't think the rule has recently changed, though, because I think that's how the rule has always been, where
if it affects the board
and then something's happened past that point, then you missed it. If it doesn't affect the board, then you can make the argument that you haven't missed it, as long as it's theoretically possible that you haven't missed it. That's my understanding.
Wait, what about like prowess? I feel like you don't have to
announce I'm pretty sure you don't have to announce it.
But that impacts the board. Your 1-1-2 becomes a 2-3.
I mean, like, in terms of like adding a counter or creating a token, I guess. That's what I mean by...
I think the final takeaway here is that we're still like very hazy on this rule, and I'm not going to try to like reinvent some sort of process, because then someone who's listening to this will like maybe take the wrong takeaways from it. But like, I think the real answer here is like, know the rules of the game. It is beneficial for you to know the rules of the game so you can avoid a situation like this.
Yeah, I think it's rare. I think
it's rare. And that in and of itself might be a problem. Just because nobody reads it doesn't mean you're like off the hook of ever having to read it.
I don't think it's reasonable to expect people to read it, though, because it's not the norm. If they set a new norm where it's like, every time we update the MTR, here's a blog, we recommend all tournament players read it, then maybe then you can, you know, at least have some level of responsibility for reading it.
If you go to a tennis game and you don't know that you hit the ball in a certain place on the field and then you lose a point because of it, and you're like, wow, that's like crazy, I didn't know about that. Like, people are going to laugh at you, right? And this is a little bit more nuanced than that, in that the rule is like super, super, super like nuanced, I guess, or like niche or whatever, but still like... the same sort of concept applies. I mean, I'll give you two the final word on this, and then we'll just move on to a different topic.
All right, yeah, I don't have anything really further on the topic either. Anurag, did you have any other updates, or should we move on to the Twitter questions?
Yeah, two things. I ran the DreamHack show, finally. So I was basically the person who did everything, like organized the stuff, and then the broadcast went out and people watched it. And I think overall, it was a pretty interesting experience. And then I got COVID.
Were the two related?
I think so, because like I came back from DreamHack and I was like not feeling well the next day or whatever. And I was like, this is kind of dumb. And was COVID positive after that. So I don't know. But the COVID part's like less interesting than the actual, like what it's like to run a show and like be in charge of like other people who are technically minded. And then also it's related to Magic. And so for me, I think there was a lot that I learned. The first is that money solves all your problems. But then the second is that there's like a lot of different roles. So we had like a director who also was doing production. I would like to have those two roles separate in the future, but budget, whatever. We had like a lot of things to work on in terms of like graphics that were updated live. We had interviews and you know, sort of the process of recording the interview to uploading it to the stream so that people could watch it like in a sensible way. And then also like, you know, as the matches were being recorded, talking to, you know, the judge on our team and making sure that they were able to explain to the players everything that needed to be done. Like, the team was actually incredible. So I do want to give a shout out to Corey Anthro, Jeff Foster, Jordan Baker, and Tannen Grace for doing an incredible job over the weekend. Without any of these people, there would have been no coverage with for DreamHack Atlanta. And then also, speaking of which, you know, massive shout out to just John Carter for being like a great mentor, sort of, and also making sure that a lot of the stuff that I've been hearing up until the show, day of the show, got passed over and actually executed. So while everything wasn't perfect, I think there was a lot of good stuff, and I think there's a lot of improvement for San Diego that could happen. And I've got a giant list of things that I'd like to have improved by then. So yeah, pretty eye-opening experience. If you ever want to hear more about that, just let me know what it's like running admin side on tournaments and things like that. Pretty cool stuff. That's about it.
Did you like enjoy that? Like, it seems like commentating is its own thing, but running a show is a totally different thing. Like,
it was a lot more stressful than I thought, because in a sense, the show was my product, and anytime something wrong happened, it's a reflection of myself and then also the people that I'm working with.
So did Wizards hire you, or DreamHack hire you?
So this was actually this was not like one of those like the backpack streams or anything like this. This was like a proper show where like We had staff. We got paid. It was all taken care of. And it felt really good once to like not have to like sweat like, oh, who's going to pay for the flight? Who's going to pay for the hotel? Who's going to pay for the internet? Who's going to pay for the casters? Who's going to pay for all that sort of stuff like I am for Eternal Weekend? That was something nice. And I did appreciate that. And it makes me, if I can do more of those, I think there is a real future for coverage. If I can't really do more of those, then it's tricky because...
Wait, so is Card Titan not paying you to do coverage?
Correct.
Okay, that's unfortunate.
I agree. So the problem is like I haven't been able to really get in touch with them. I'm not going to get too much into it because now's not the time, but like hopefully when I show up there on like Wednesday or Thursday, I need to just find a way to become like an official stream, because even right now I am technically not the official Eternal Weekend stream, which is to me the most annoying thing out of anything else. The one relief from this weekend was that this was a show where I did not have to worry about finances, where I've spent the whole year worrying about finances, right? Like I even at this point, like I think I have to figure out like, it's complicated and I don't want to think about it right now because it's like overwhelming, so I'm not going to think about it. But yeah, money is always an issue for coverage and things like that. And so but yeah, why don't we move on to some of the Twitter questions.
All right, here's a question that I saw that somebody deleted, but I really wanted to ask this, especially since you deleted it. So Vuk, that's Ozymandias17, he won the showcase with 60 card for color control. Does this mean it's better than 80 card for color control? And this is from one of our patrons, Darth Dog.
I'm gonna assume this question's for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a safe assumption.
Yeah, David, I think realistically, my answer here is I don't know if 60 card is necessarily better because...
Well, I think what's changed is obviously elephant in the room. There's a new deck in the format, White Stompy, and you're required to, you know, have your answers pretty much immediately. Otherwise, you just die. And also some of the extra cards you were trying to fit in, like Narset, maybe are less good right now in the meta.
Right. So I think like legitimately that there are a couple good things about his deck. Not playing Narset makes a lot of sense to me. I was telling a couple other people that I don't like Narset right now and I want to cut it, but they were like, oh, Narset's really good. And I was like, no, it's not really good. And then like Voke winning without Narset is a nice little like vote of confidence for that. I think it's basically just Force of Will is really important right now. I don't know. I feel like in most matchups that aren't Delver, like that's like the number one card you want to see all the time, every time. Going from 60 to 80 does mitigate your chances of that, and I think that is a little bit of a problem. But that's also a really bad sign. If Force of Will is that important to your deck, then your deck is probably like not very well positioned.
I kind of disagree with that because I see it another way, because I just think the format's gotten so powerful that you just need to have access to Force of Will. I mean, basically this White Stompy deck, if you don't have Force of Will for the turn one White Plume Adventurer, like it's too late already. They're going to start accruing cards and or damage, and you might not be able to recover in time. And Force of Will is pretty much the only card that interacts well against, you know, turn one White Plume Adventure. Like Force of Negation doesn't really quite work because, yeah, you could Force of Negation a Chrome Mox or a Lotus Petal, but most of the time that's not going to be a winning play.
Yeah, Force of Negation has been really bad for a decent amount of time. I think ever since I started playing three Pyroblast in my deck is when I kind of was like, yeah, I don't want to play Force of Negation at all. I think it's just like Force of Will too important, so maybe 60 card is fine compared to 80, but I'm also unsure of what, because like you're right, cards like Narset, they kind of suck. The only cards that I really am like sad to see go are like the second Mystic Sanctuary, for example,
third and fourth Minsk and Boo. Yeah, Voke mentioned maybe he could see playing three, but
I think Voke wants the third Minsk and Boo or like a Torpor Orb in the sideboard. So there's still ways to fit that in, which I think I am quite happy with, because Minsk and Boo does a lot in a lot of other matchups as well, whereas Torpor Orb kind of narrow and also can come down after the fact, and that's when it's really bad, which is why like I'm a huge fan of like Dress Down right now. I think overall, like,
all right, it sounds like you're undecided, but you think that 60 cards makes more sense than it did in the past, you know, few weeks.
Well, I'll just say this, it's just like when the meta gets really unfair, then 60 card probably is better than 80, and it seems like we're at a point where maybe the meta is becoming that. So,
well, I don't know if the meta is it's somewhat unfair. Definitely, it does seem like decks like Jeskai Control have kind of fallen by the wayside because they don't match up well against four color control, as well as they don't match up well against this White Stompy deck. But let's talk about this new initiative Stompy deck. And actually, I'm curious about how you feel about the control matchup, because the default assumption was, oh, this deck is really good against control. But then Vuk obviously won the entire event, beating White Stompy, and he definitely beat it more than a couple times during the event. So how do you feel about the matchup overall, and how do you like, what is a like winning way that you play out the matchup?
So here's another thing too, where I just feel like somehow someone somewhere was like, yeah, control is unlosable. And then I was like, oh, wow, okay, all right. Like, that's kind of interesting. And then I played against the deck like twice and I was like, this does not feel like an unlosable matchup. And then I saw Voke play and he went 4-1 in the showcase, and like that's like some of the best players you might see playing this deck, and like that is an alarmingly good record. I think he went like toe-to-toe with XJ, who went 9-0 in the event. XJ won in the Swiss, Voke won in the finals, so like I don't think it's that bad. I would calibrate by maybe playing some copies of like Dress Down and things like that, but like look, like if your opponent is gonna go turn one Cavern, mox White Plume Adventure or whatever, all right, you were losing this game no matter what, and there's nothing you could have done about it. Okay, so we're gonna ignore those kind of scenarios. I think the more average case scenario is where like people just like don't mulligan. They'll keep a hand that has like a turn two like three drop or something like that, whether it's like Spellbinder or Peacekeeper, Anointed Peacekeeper or something like that, and usually those are not going to involve Cavern either. So if you have your force and you're able to stop exactly the initiative creature, the deck entirely just crumbles apart. Like if they don't have their initiative threat on turn one or two, like before you can start to stabilize your mana and do sort of like just control things, they're in for a bad time, right? And I think that's what Voke was like too. He was just like, yeah, and a lot of these matchups, like people just kept like whatever hands against me and they didn't have an initiative creature fast enough. And by the time they did get an initiative creature, I had flashed in an endurance and then I had like a removal spells to clear the way and just take it from them and just like win the game with them. Like I will say that like in 2018, when Grixis Delver was at its strongest, one of my favorite cards was Palace Jailer, because it's just like one of those things where like you're so good as a control deck in like keeping it because you control the board so well. And I think the same thing applies when you're trying to attack the control deck with a Monarch like mechanic, is that like naturally like you will be good at acquiring it and taking it. The one thing is that you don't really have very many creatures, but like these decks nowadays have endurance, these decks nowadays have like Uro, and then they also have the hamster. The hasty hamster of all things is incredible at stealing the initiative. So overall, I wouldn't really be too panicked as a control player. I think there wasn't really much special in Voke's deck, but I think A, going down to 60 cards, not a bad idea. B, playing cards like Dress Down. If you really want Torpor Orb, you can play it. Like stopping ETB abilities is nice, but beyond that, I don't think I'm going to overreact. Like the games you lose are the ones where absurd shit happens. Otherwise, you're just playing a back and forth game where they do get some value out of it. But like the Monarch mechanic is way scarier to me than the initiative, right?
If you're going down the left side, then you're just dealing damage and control can often, you know, recover from that. And if you're going down the right side, it's not that many cards. So, and it does take them a while to, you know, get one creature out of it. And again, your deck is built to answer creatures, basically.
Right. And so I think the scariest mode is like maybe trap. And then here's the other thing too, is just is like, if you're not playing Terminus right now, you're struggling. And I don't know why you would want to struggle. Terminus is really, really good right now. And so maybe that's why control is actually in a good position, because your number one removal spell is like, you know, awesome. Because, you know, Terminus is awesome and stuff like that. So I don't know. Yeah, I feel like you just have like a lot of good answers already and a lot of good tools to win. So that's just my take on it.
Okay, cool. Let's go to the next Twitter question. Explain the progress, I think, process of adapting. Is it just, you know, changing a few sideboard slots, adding tech to the main, splashing a color, you know, changing decks entirely? What's overreacting? And this is from our friend Marcus at Truckus123. So yeah, go ahead.
It depends how much time you have to test, but usually I would just kind of play the matchup, see how it is, see like what cards are bad. So, you know, those are the cards you might want to side out. Like if you play the matchup and you find, you know, some cards are really bad, then you want to make room to side them out. Yeah, just like playing the matchup, you get an idea of kind of like what you want your deck to look like, or maybe if the matchup you can't solve it, or you can't fix it and like have a reasonable other matchups, then you might need to switch decks. But that's how I would try and adapt a new deck. Basically, like play the matchup and see how it is, and then make changes from that.
I agree with that. Let me give some more advice as to that. Here's what I like to do, is I like to basically play the matchup with the two decks and test certain cards. So for instance, you know, if I'm trying to test True Name Nemesis or Sprite Dragon or, God forbid, Unchained Berserker in Blue-Red Delver against Mono White, maybe I'll just play a post-board game with that card in my hand and see how it feels. And the other thing to try as well, and this is what I like to do, is I like to put, you know, the deck that you're testing against on the draw, or on the play rather. So for instance, if White Stompy is the deck to beat, then I want White Stompy to be on the play and to where they have a natural advantage. But then I want to see, you know, if Blue Red Delver on the draw with this sideboard card, is it still able to kind of win these matchups on the draw. Because I think if it can, then I think it bodes well for the matchup. But if it can't, or if it's closer to 50-50, then that's when I, you know, decide I might want more help in the matchup. So that's like the specific test case I like to do if I'm trying to beat a specific deck. I try to see if I can win post-board games on the draw against that deck.
There's an interesting question, which is like, what is overreacting that Marcus is asking about? And to me, I don't know. I feel like, first of all, like the first thing is just like to not like hastily jump to a conclusion. I don't know what a good sample size is, but like if you're at the level of Magic that you normally play at, Marcus specifically, like you're a very good player, right? So you know more than anything else, like when your deck is actually struggling and when you know what like proper struggling feels like. And that's the general vibe that I would actually, you can look at, you can look a lot of like technical reasons and things like that. But one of the things that I do is because I don't play nearly as much as I need to, I just vibe check a lot of things, right? Like when it's mono white versus control, for example, like that matchup, I was like, I just like vibe checked it. I was like, all right, well, I understand like what could really go wrong. I'm not going to let like my opponent going turn one cavern mox, you know, initiative creature be what decides my opinion on this sort of matchup. Removed from the extreme cases and you think about things a little bit more level-headedly and like say like, all right, well, like out of 100 games, how many times is it going to actually happen? Think about the actual play patterns and then make a like a vibe about that kind of deal and then use that sort of as the preliminary base one. Like, and I'm only saying this as like someone who has played Legacy for years and years and years and years, and you know, like, okay, like back in the day when, like, you know, Predict was the best thing to be doing in Miracles, and that's why people would play Spell Snare, like, and then that kind of thing, up until the point of, like, okay, well, you know, like now Drago doesn't exist anymore because Narset and Teferi are here now. Like, you just have a certain understanding of it, right? And that core understanding is what I would pursue. I would not look to any of the crazy shit that happens, like, oh no, like, you know, it was like my opponent hit four dazes in their top 20 cards, Delver is unwinnable. Like, don't jump to the conclusions. That kind of deal, you know, nothing too crazy. It's one of those things where I would just say, like, if you do feel overwhelmed by a certain matchup or a certain play pattern or like something like that, like a certain testing session or whatever like that, just like stop playing for 2 days and something like that, and then come back and be like, all right, maybe with a fresh mind I can sort of understand like why certain things happen this way, reevaluate your games and approach them from a level-headed mindset. I don't know.
I will say though, I think the difference between this mono white deck and prior decks is I think it is good at playing something on turn one and then potentially on turn two with a cavern. Like in your example you listed, like you said people were going turn one like Sol Land Go. I don't think that's as common. I think turn one I'm usually trying to play like something maybe like a Chrome Mox plus a Thalia or maybe a Chalice of the Void on one. So like I feel like these decks typically you want to start the game on turn one, force your opponent to, you know, force yourself to be in an advantageous position or force your opponent to have the force for the first turn. And then on the second turn or third turn, you play the cavern and you play the initiative creature and you've already kind of put some pressure on your opponent. So I feel like that's more the more base case scenario than doing nothing on turn one. But anyways, kind of going back to Marcus's question, I think it definitely depends on your deck as well. And there will be times where it's like, wow, your deck just really does not line up well against this new deck that you're trying to beat, and maybe that's okay sometimes. For instance, I think one matchup that is really lopsided for the White Stompy deck is White Stompy against lands. Basically, once you gain the initiative, lands has a really difficult time taking it back, and then you have enough removal spells to answer, you know, their Saga tokens or Endurance, as well as Merit Lodge. So I think that matchup is really bad for lands. I've played it like 4 or 5 times, and so has PVDH, and he's like, yeah, you can't really lose. So sometimes, you know, there might be a new deck that arrives that your deck really struggles to beat. And when you come to that situation, I think you can either, you can do two things. One, you can just like, you know, maybe you stop playing your deck for a bit. You see what else is going on. And the other thing you can do is like, yeah, you can try like crazy sideboard cards, or you can try, I believe Ali said he's trying Glacial Chasm again, because a lot of these White Stompy decks don't play Wasteland. So you do have to kind of just put yourself in the position of like, oh, you can either take a break or you can like try certain things to beat it. And even if you try certain things, you might not be able to beat it. Most of the time, that's usually fine because a new deck isn't going to be like super dominant. But I think this is kind of the rare case of, hey, there is this new deck in Legacy and hey, it is winning a heck of a lot of matches. It was winning basically 65% of the matches during the showcase. And that's like 2 weeks in, people are aware of the deck and are like have it in the forefront. Now what we're seeing is basically in the last chance qualifiers, people are playing like really targeted hate. People are playing cards like Perish, Unchained Berserker, and I think the one key thing to keep in mind is you do have to actually test against these decks, because I've played this White Stompy deck and I've beaten Parrish a whole bunch of times just because of the fact that, like, hey, if you never steal back the initiative, I'm happy just kind of sitting here accruing more cards and redeploying. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, you actually do need to, like, test and see if your idea works or not.
The only other thing that I would really think about, too, is just, like on a lower level, too. Like, let's say, like, there are other types of adaptation as well. I think one big form of adaptation is how I added Hydro Blast to my sideboard. Well, my friend Daniel Gochel bought many, many copies of Hydro Blast, and I wanted to improve... No, I'm kidding. I didn't... That's a bad joke. But for that one, I was slowly realizing that playing against Delver, you know, like analyzing the game and the play patterns and finding out exactly where I lost, I found out that I was just losing to like cheesy cards like Maddening Hex and Price of Progress. I also at the time realized that Mono Red was a deck that was getting a lot better, and I wanted to find a card that... So here's the thing with like all my sideboard slots, the goal is to find something that is versatile but also powerful. So in this sense, I was looking for exactly Hydro Blast, versatile in that it stopped a lot of the ways that I lost to Delver, but also it was really good against Blood Moon, which at the time was, you know, very, very, very played, overplayed almost. And yeah, I think rather than continue playing with like a lot of the shitty cards that I was playing, you know, just like saying like, all right, like time, because Hydro Blast is a card that I never really enjoyed playing, but I think it just... Like understanding that it solved very specific types of problems was key in my commitment to the card.
I think for a control player, like what you put in your deck, like has a huge effect, obviously. And because you're playing the control role, you actually need to like evaluate cards because they change as the metagame changes. Like for instance, you know, you weren't playing Ice Fang Quaddle for a while. Maybe it's a time to reconsider that card because it's good at stealing back the initiative. Like, I think you need to kind of continually reevaluate cards as different, you know, top decks change. Sometimes it might be a Hydro Blast day. Sometimes you got to, you know, tweak your deck to include these like flash flying creatures. So I think as a control player, like you always have to be thinking about like, what am I trying to beat and what cards accomplish that?
Yeah, I think so too, right? So I don't want to say that there's like only one type of like an adaptation. I think they're like just like small things. And it just boils down to like, look at the play patterns. What's going on? What are you losing to? What do you need to fix, right? How do you fix that? Okay, well, you just change one or two slots that like still apply value in certain directions, but then also apply value in sort of fixing the problem that you're trying to fix, right? So like, I think that's what I'm trying to get at with the Hydro Blast scenario is that it solved a very big hole, which was I couldn't handle these two subsets of problems. And literally just that, right? I think because everything else was mostly taken care of, so I understood like, okay, I can beat most other matchups except for this one play pattern and then this other play pattern. So that's what my sideboard is like. The sideboard is there to solve problems. You have to know what those problems are first. Okay, cool. I think I got that makes a lot of sense. Sorry, I was like not sure if I was answering the question properly or not, but I think it is just identify the problems and then have versatile cards that answer multiple problems at the same time, just so that you have like a well-rounded sideboard kind of deal, right?
So yeah, I mean, we've already been alluding to it, but yeah, the main topic of the day is just initiative Stompy and probably more importantly, like how to beat it. So first, obviously, you guys have, you know, all heard about the win rate. XJ Cloud is himself, especially, you know, he compared this to basically like, he's like, oh, this is one of the best decks I've ever played, like maybe comparable to Zerda, which got banned. So, you know, we're not going to talk too much about the B word here. I still think Legacy has plenty of tools to adapt and adjust. Like, this is not like Pauper. Pauper is like a very, very slow format. And so when Initiative came into Pauper, it was like, oh yeah, you play Dark Ritual, you play this Initiative creature on turn 2. These decks in Pauper are just not set up to beat it at all. Basically, people were building like brand new decks based around like Koldotha Rebirth to like make tokens to steal back the Initiative. But like, that's not the situation in Legacy. The situation in Legacy is, hey, we have Force of Will. There's other cards we can play to kind of target this deck or steal back the initiative. Legacy already was a very fast format. It's just what's new is there's a new deck that is very fast, and it's basically giving Stompy decks a source of card advantage, which is always scary. It's kind of like, you know, when we started giving Delver decks card advantage, now Stompy decks have it too, both from kind of the initiative creatures and from Fable, and we've definitely seen like a corresponding uptick. So I think this deck is very good, and it's probably, maybe I would say it's probably half a tier above Moon Stompy and 8-cast. And remember, when those decks came out, they were also tier 1 and winning at a really high rate, but probably not as high as this deck. I do think the format can adjust to it. I think in particular, like, I think Delver is set up decently to go toe-to-toe against this deck, because you have the Wastelands for the Caverns, and you have Murktide Regent, which can be a hard card for them to answer. Like, they basically have Plow and Touch the Spirit Realm. Touch is a little bit clunky. You can maybe try to daze it, and then Plow doesn't work if they have a Chalice out as well. And they're basically forced to, you know, leave in both Chalice and Swords of Plowshares against you and just hope their cards line up. So I definitely think Delver is probably a pretty reasonable way to beat the deck, especially if you play certain sideboard cards. I'm not totally sure what the best sideboard threats are. I do think that going the threat path is the best way to beat the deck. Obviously, Unchained Berserker is probably the best one. However, it's the most narrow. I think I was advocating for third path Iconoclast. That's basically the new Young Pyromancer. However, I think that card is like fine in the matchup, but it doesn't necessarily swing things. Other cards I would consider trying would be like, you know, Rich Callie was telling me good things about True Name Nemesis, similar to Iconoclast, but it costs one more mana, but at least it's more relevant in more matchups. Like, I could see bringing it against Control and having it be fine. Then last card would be Sprite Dragon, which is a good card for stealing back the initiative. I'm not sure out of these four, like, which one is the best. I would have to kind of try them all a little bit more just to see. But I think any deck that can basically steal back the initiative has a pretty good shot. So whether that's in Delver or Control, and then you have your own removal to keep their board clear, or you can kind of try to like sidestep the initiative by winning faster than them, i.e. like winning on turn one with either a Grizzlebrand, or maybe like going through them by playing like Omniscience or something. It's hard for them to like interact with. I think there are like combo decks, Painter as well. If you can kind of combo them, they're usually not killing you on turn three, so usually you can race them with some sort of combo. I think that's where I would kind of lean towards. The decks that are bad against initiative are basically the fair non-blue decks that are a little bit slow and not good at taking back the initiative. So like Depths and Lands are decks I would probably avoid.
But would you play Sprite Dragon out of the sideboard?
You could. I mean, you could play it main deck. The problem is it's not that powerful of a card.
Yeah.
I could see, I don't know, maybe you could play it over the Delvers, because Delver is really good, you know, turn one on the play, but then, you know, half the games you're on the draw and they might have a Chalice and then Delver's bad. So maybe you could replace Delvers in your deck with Sprite Dragon and play it main. I'm not sure like what the optimal configuration might be.
Third Path and True Name sound like the best cards. There's one more card that I want to sneakily ask Daniel about, and I'm sure he's got like reactions to this. But Daniel, how do you feel about Stifle?
I mean, my first reaction would be like, I don't really want to play it. Maybe it's good in some world, but it's kind of like when people were talking about Torpor Orb. That's a card that's like, it sounds like it might be good, but it sounds not great to me, because it's kind of slow, it's two mana, so like it can be hard to cast. Even if you're on the play, maybe you have a turn one guy. If you're on the draw, it's really slow. If you're like in the middle of the game and top deck it, it might be bad. But I might underrate it, because I could imagine if I was playing mono white, maybe there's some games.
Well, Stifle seems absurdly insane, because it's also good against like Touch the Spirit Realm too, right? And Solitude. Like, you get to play like pure tempo with this card, because it's not only like good at stopping there, it's not only good like defensively, but it's also very good proactively. And this is a rare case for Stifle, actually, because generally speaking I feel like Stifle sucks.
Yeah,
it's not great against Chalice, which obviously you could say about most one draws, but like it depends where it's coming from, because if it's in the main it's different. Like if I was siding cards, the main cards I would be looking at, it's just like cards that answer Chalice, like Meltdown, Brotherhood's Hand, stuff like that. Obviously they're like don't take the initiative, but you don't really have that many answers to Chalice in your deck. Maybe you like don't need to answer it or whatever, but that's what I would be looking at first. I also think Ledger Shredder is a creature I like in general. I mean, I don't know if it's that good in this matchup, but it's like kind of good against Chalice. I'm probably gonna play for Ledger. I guess that's not the question. Yeah, I just Stifle is a card. I like to like tap out every turn, so whenever a card like makes me hold up mana, I basically think the opportunity cost of holding up mana can be pretty big, and there can be like awkward times when they like play something that you can't stifle. So basically the reasons I would say I'm hesitant is I think like the opportunity cost to hold it up is pretty big, and like if they don't do something you can stifle, it'll be like kind of bad for you, because then you might like waste your mana. Like if they play like Peacekeeper, I mean, I don't, that might be an enters, but it's also like not good to stifle it. That would be my answer. I don't know if that's a good one.
Yeah, I think that maybe one difference is like maybe there's some triggers that happen later in the game, like Anurag mentioned Solitude and Touch the Spirit Realm, and those turns you might have the mana to hold up. So I could see it being, you know, maybe more useful than it is against other decks, but again, it's something I would want to test out.
Well, also let me ask you this question, but how does the ruling work? Like, let's say you go into Throne of the Dead, whatever, the final room in the Undercity. Can you stifle that trigger? Trigger to find something? Is it a trigger to find something, or how does that work?
I mean, stifle could be good. I just have an aversion to... I like to tap out and use all my mana every turn. That's kind of my play style.
Yeah.
But it could be interesting. I just hate whenever people start talking about stifle, because I don't like when my fetch lands are stifle, so I gotta like put down this fire before it picks up, you know what I mean? Whenever yeah. stifle is dead, it's like, let's just keep it dead. I don't want any fetch land, you know. But it could be interesting to try, but the downside, yeah, you have to think about is holding up the mana is like a pretty big cost.
So I'm not 100% sure, but I think they just don't enter the next room, because how initiative is worded is whenever you take the initiative and at the beginning of your upkeep venture into the Undercity, which means advance into the next room. So I don't think you can actually, like, the room is not a trigger. Although, actually, on Magic Online, it is a trigger. Okay, so maybe, I think there are, I think there's two triggers, right? There's one trigger for you to move into the next room, and then another trigger for what the room is. So I think you can stifle it.
Okay, but what about other decks besides Delver, right? Like, so Delver clearly has some tools, but, like, are the green-white depths mages, are they like out of luck on this one? Or what about like mono-red as a deck? Is that good against mono-white? Like what are some of the non-Delver, non-control things that we can maybe look to think about for Eternal Weekend? Like,
I think mono-red is fine in the matchup. Basically, all of the creatures that create another token, like those cards are really good at stealing back the initiative as well as being really aggressive. So I know Jarvis lost to Mono Red during the showcase. So I think that matchup's pretty close. Most of these matchups just come down to the die roll, which is kind of not super interesting. But maybe there are a couple ways to like break serve with like some sort of like sweeper effect. I don't know, something crazy like Anarchy might be interesting.
Is that like destroy all white creatures or something?
I'm pulling it up. So it's 2 red, destroy all white permanents.
Oh, permanents. Oh, wow. It's even crazier. Okay, yeah.
Maybe they can play Sylvan Safekeeper. I mean, it gets Chalice. I mean, I guess they already play it, but, you know, if there's new tech. Because they don't, like, play Wasteland in a lot of the mono-white lists. So, like, and they have a lot of, like, Plows. So it seems like that might be a decent card in the matchup. But I guess if they already have Green Sun, it might not be that flashy of a card.
Does Elves have a good matchup against Mono White?
Well, it seems like they would be good off the top of my head, just because like Mono White doesn't have that much interaction. Like they have Chalice and some Plows.
I played against it 3 times and I was 2-1 against Elves. However, some of those times was against like the Glimpse build. I don't know. I don't have enough of a sample size to really say. Basically, if they, you know, do their thing with Allosaurus Shepherd on like turn 2 or 3 and glimpse off, then yeah, you're in trouble. But then against the other list that's slower, that's probably like, I'm trying to think of like what they have against you. They just play a bunch of small creatures. That doesn't seem very scary. So maybe like the glimpse list might be better.
Yeah, it seems like the white decks, I mean, it kind of does have a fast clock in a way, but it doesn't have like a, you know, super, like you can Wirewood Symbiote block this stuff. And then Elves can kind of like...
Well, you can't block Seasoned Dungeoneer.
Oh yeah, you can't block that one. Or the Flyers. But it seems like Elves, like since... It seems like Elves goes a little bit bigger than the white deck. But obviously like Chalice could randomly blow them out. But it seems like the Elves decks just like... Usually the Elves decks like good against the white creature decks. Because the Elf creatures are kind of like... It's like a combo creature deck. Against a, like a deck that doesn't have that much interaction. But maybe it's close.
They well, post board you usually have like... You usually have like 3 to 4 Mind Sensor / Containment Priest effects. So then that can stop you from losing to Natural Order, which is the main thing that the slower Elves decks plays now, Orcs. So I could see...
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if the game goes on, like, if you don't play Wasteland, like, you don't have an answer to Cradle. So it seems like if they have Cradle for, like, a few turns, like, and they have stuff to do, it's going to be kind of hard for White. I would see the matchup being close, but I would say, yeah, Cradle seems like it could be pretty annoying. If that's getting value in play. I don't know if the white deck has that many answers to Cradle.
But yeah, okay, Daniel, talk to me a little bit more about like what creature suite you want to try in Delver. You said you're going to play like, what, basically 4 DRC, 4 Shredder, 4 Murktide. Are you going to play any other threats?
Yeah, well, I haven't tested the matchup yet, so I need to do that soon. I've heard like some people playing it. But yeah, so before this new initiative deck came out, I was like pretty sure I was going to play my deck that has like no Wastelands, no Delvers, and a bunch of Unholy Heats. I was just going to be like blue-red kind of Murktide mid-range. And I was like pretty happy with that. But now this new Stompy deck came out. So like Delver gets a bit better and maybe Wasteland gets better too.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that because obviously Delver's better on the play and then it's better on the draw when they don't have Chalice. Probably better than Shredder overall. But then if you're on the play, like, Shredder's probably also pretty good.
I'll have to, yeah, think about that more. I was thinking when I would win the matchup from the Delver side, I always, like, kind of play it like a control deck. So I'd be like, I would try and win by having total control of the game. And then, like, so I'd be fine not having Delver. Like, I would just try and kind of answer their stuff. Or maybe it'll be kind of, like, hard to answer their stuff. And that game plan won't be great.
To me, you win the game two ways. One is, like, my preferred way is basically just prolong the game and they will flood out and lose. Yeah, they might, like, draw a Myriad's Call or play a Myriad's Call, but usually you can, like, daze that. Because they basically don't really have too much card, or well, I say they don't have too much card advantage, but, like, as long as they don't have the initiative, like, continuing to go, if you're, like, trading back and forth, they'll eventually flood out. And then the other way is you can actually just race them if you are able to, you know, flip a Delver, put two counters on it. Then you can often, like, race them and you can, like, delay them with cards like Borrower. Basically, you just need to make sure they don't have a Chalice and then you just play your regular game. And I think you should be fine as long as you don't get, like, you know, super tempoed out.
Yeah, because, like, I wasn't planning to play Delver, but I was like, this definitely, I could see why Delver would be very high value in some spots.
Wait, you weren't planning to play Delver? Oh, okay, like the card. Okay, you're still playing the deck, but just not the card. Okay, my bad.
Yeah, like Murktide. Yeah, for a while. I mean, I kind of noticed that when I win, I usually just try, like, end up just winning prolonged games where, like, I just trade back and forth and then I win. So Delver wasn't really helping me that much. It's like kind of, so, like, I'd rather just focus on controlling the game. So that's why I was just playing, like, Ledger and those stuff. But yeah, with this, I was like, okay, maybe I have to reevaluate it a little bit. But yeah, I also like Ledger Shredder against Chalice. Like you were saying, like, Ledger can be pretty powerful against Chalice. But yeah, it was pretty tricky when looking for Cyborg cards. Because also, Brotherhood's End was a card I was extremely excited for to play. I mean, I'm probably going to play it. But it's, like, not as good against this deck as, like Meltdown's probably better. Though I guess not in all spots. Like, the thing is, like, the lists are built a bit differently. So, like, some of them have slightly different creature suites. And I guess a lot of them do play, like, Spellbinder and the other stuff. So, like, the 3 damage mode's, like, not horrendous. I also am planning to play 4 Unholy Heat, which should be good. Though I guess it'll be awkward if I don't have Delirium and they have the 3/3. But, like, also, since I don't play Delver, I have a bit more 1-mana removal. Like, I play 4 Heats and 2 Bolts. But, yeah, I was going to say, like, Brotherhood's End's a card that I'm really excited for. Not in this matchup in particular, but I'll probably side it in because it kills all the artifacts.
What matchups are you excited it for? Like, basically, what, Elves, Death and Taxes?
Well, the reason was, before, I always wanted to play, like, 2 Pyroclasm cards, and I always wanted to play, like, 2 Ancestor Chalice, and it was, like, basically kind of hard to, like, so it's just going to save sideboard slots, like, so, previously I had, like, 2 Explosives and 2 Pyroclasms, like, months ago, and now I'm just going to play, like, 2 or 3 Brotherhood's End, because it does both at the same time, and also it's, like, kind of convenient, because, like, if you play against, like, random decks like Goblins or Merfolk, and they randomly play a Chalice, now your, like, Pyroclasm card can kill that too.
Okay, but what about playing it with... If you're playing Shredder, that makes complete sense. You only kill your own DRC, but then if you play it with Delver, it kills your own Delver as well. I feel like that's a tension that I'm like, I'm not sure if I want to play this card.
It's worse in Delver. As you can see, there's many reasons I don't like Delver. It doesn't do it. It always doesn't get along with what plans I want to do. I would definitely say, yeah, if you're playing Delver, Brotherhood's End seems worse, but it's mostly saving sideboard slots. Like, now I'm just going to have more sideboard slots than I did previously. And also, like, just the fact that, like, yeah, like, it's a bit better. But definitely has tension with Delver, so it might be less excited. I think that the fact that it deals damage to Planeswalkers is really powerful. I guess there's not that many Planeswalkers in Legacy, so it won't come up that much. But, like, that's something, like, most board wipes don't say. I mean, and the Festivity says. So I'm pretty excited. Like, I think there's just, like, a lot of small stuff that make it better than it seems. Like, being an artifact and creature board wipe and dealing damage to Planeswalkers, I just think it's going to be, like, better, play out better than it looks, and it'll be really exciting for, like, red players, I guess.
All right, sounds like we all have some kind of more testing to do. Like I said, I think the Initiative Stompy deck is very good. I think it could become, like, you know, a mainstay in the format. I don't think it's going to be like more quote unquote problematic than Delver. The only thing I see as more problematic is, like, the games end much faster, but I guess even against Delver, like, yeah, maybe you were still in the game for longer, but I don't know, maybe you weren't, like, really in it. I don't really know what I'm trying to say. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, don't panic. The deck is very good. Let's adapt for, you know, a few more months. And then if it still ends up being super good, then maybe we can start to panic a little bit. But for now, I'm not super panicked.
Yeah, that's a funny way to put it. Yes. Don't panic until it's time to panic and then panic. All right. I like that a lot. But yeah, I think that is probably where I would put my thoughts as well. Is I think it's beatable. It's like the third week. People are gonna overreact. You guys already know it. If you've been playing Legacy for a while, you know this is just like the general like spin of things. And so I would just say hold tight. We'll figure it out. Eternal Weekend, I think, though, will be absolutely positively infested with this deck because this deck is a lot cheaper in paper. I don't think the cards are that hard to get if you just like, you know, buy them in advance. So we'll see how much of a result it puts up. But yeah, otherwise, any final thoughts for the episode today?
Yeah, one thing I would say is I think the scary card in the deck is not like the actual creatures. It's just Ancient Tomb and City of Traders and the fact that it's colorless. Like if you weren't literally ramping into this with like Ancient Tomb, I don't think it would be that scary. So I think those are the real cards that I'm not saying to ban them or anything, but those are the cards that stand out as powerful to me. Ancient Tomb and City of Traders, not the actual tree drop, despite like the tree drop's really good.
Yeah. That's a pretty base take.
Yeah, I mean, true, but we're not gonna undo that genie. And I think the 4-mana one is definitely reasonable and not too scary. But putting basically like a, more or less like a monarch thing at 3-mana threat is definitely pushing it a little bit, shall we say?
All right, everybody. Well, we're gonna wrap up episode 37. If you had a good time, let us know on Twitter. If you have any questions you may want to ask us about this, if any thoughts about Eternal Weekend or Legacy prep going in. Let us know at ELOPunters on Twitter. Gonna wrap up this episode. My name's Anurag. We're here with Daniel and Bob, and we'll see you for the next one. After Eternal Weekend, most likely? Yeah. All right. Bye.